Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the National Coalition of Women of Color Blog Talk Radio Show. We are celebrating Women's Month for the month of March. The NCWCC is celebrating the history of women in the month of March who are on the cutting edge of their industry. Tune in for special guests and roundtable discussions on issues that affect our lives, our community, our businesses. Listen in for workshops on how to build capacity, life coaching skills in construction, and obtaining the requirements in working in the new green markets. You have reached your host, Karima Ali. I am the public policy director and the host of your show, as well as a business owner. And I would like to thank all the folks that are online today. We have a very interesting, a very strong subject matter that is very life-threatening and very dear to some of the callers that are on the show right now. I want to welcome our guest on the show, Nadine Livy from Upbuild Design, who is a licensed architectural firm, and she's a licensed architect in Atlanta, Georgia. And we like her to the show and just thank her for coming on at short notices. But she is one of our honored guests on the discussion for this. Nadine, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Karima.
Okay. And welcome, caller from 313 area code.
Hello. How are you?
Very great. Thank you. Caller from 706 area code. Welcome to the call.
Hi, thanks so much for calling.
Okay. Caller from 651, welcome to the call.
Hey, what's up, Karima?
Okay, great. Thank you. Welcome to the call, Ms. Janora. Wanted to start off the subject for today. I want to go into a digital wire from ENR.com News regarding architectural firms. And the first part of this conversation, I want to go into an article that I read only moments ago that really is very frightening to know that this is going on. And after reading this, I need an expert regarding this matter. It says that in this particular article, it talks about the firms that are having says phony engineers. This is from March 28, 2010, from the Baltimore Sun in Maryland. On February 28, framed professional licenses from three states and John Hopkins University diploma hung on the wall of Lawrence D. Nakowski's office at a firm where he made six-figure income as an electrical engineer. This poises as a rare and but dangerous problem. The article states that, but the firm who paid the gentleman the six figures likely ordered off the internet. This gentleman was 51 years old, which is a Westminster resident, has no engineering degree. The prosecutors say that now, they said while this is still rare, instances of employees and contractors and passing themselves off as a license appear. Okay, I need somebody to drown their background noises off the background, please. Okay. All right, we're going to, we'll take it there. I'm sorry, we just wanted to take some of the background noises off because this article is very important because of where we are in terms of this, but it states that while still rare, instances of employees or contractors passing themselves off as licensed appear to be happening more frequently. Perhaps as the recession has driven the unemployed to extremes, state officials say that the cases are worrisome because of the potential impact an unlicensed, untrained person could have on the design, construction, and the upkeep of projects, including public buildings, hospitals, and schools. Last week, regulators announced another case in which a Hagerstown man falsely represented himself as an architect and practiced without a license, the third time in less than 6 months that an investigation by Maryland Department of Labor, License and Regulation has led to criminal charges for alleged impersonation of design professionals in the state. The recent spat has alarmed state officials. Jeffrey Turo, an investigator in the department's license division, said the credential misrepresentation can be serious as violent crimes. This can just be as deadly if buildings or their systems fall or collapse. They can be more deadly than a mugger on a street with a gun. Nadine, please let our listeners know the severities of what they're describing in this article.
Well, here's what a lot of people do not understand. The building codes and the practice laws around the state require that certain types of building, because they house people in large numbers, like schools, assembly places, like churches, places of worship, restaurants, etc., typically over 3,000 or 5,000 square feet, must be designed and signed and sealed by an architect. Cannot be signed and sealed by an engineer, but by an architect. The reason why is architects are the only ones specifically trained, right, and educated and held accountable for the health, safety, and welfare of the people, occupants of that building. So, what happens if you have an unlicensed individual building your church and something happens and it falls down and kills 250, 500 people or hurts them, what happens then? Who do you go to? They've got their money, they've moved on, they don't have a license. There's no recourse for anybody to take against them. You know, so in essence, that congregation spent all that hard-earned multi-million dollars they have a mortgage for, and they have no recourse. There's no insurance. There's no place for anybody to go. Unfortunately, this practice is rampant. Even here in Georgia, I know of two particular firms. Not naming any names, who advertise themselves as architects, found to even practice architecture. One went to the extreme of using the stamp nor an architectural stamp of an individual that had passed away, that had died over 2 years ago.
Oh my God.
But they were telling their clients that they were registered architect and they had the wherewithal to do this. The other thing is, it's not just enough to simply hire an architect in these firms. Especially in Georgia, the way the Georgia law and a lot of different laws around the country is written, because of the responsibility that an architect is required to maintain on this building, and normally it's like could be up to 10 to 15 years that an architect is responsible for the design of that building. That individual in the company, that individual must be an equity or risk-taking part of the company structure, a managing member, one of the company officers, etc. Not simply a mere employee. So you can't just say, I start a firm and then I'm going to hire a couple of architects and then call myself an architect. No, the architects you hire who sign and seal the document need to be part of that corp, need to be an officer of the corporation. That's a part a lot of people do not understand, and they put themselves at risk, therefore, of having something designed,
mm-hmm.
having something built by somebody who is not responsible and cannot be held responsible for the work they did. And if you and buildings are so expensive, most buildings cost of any decent size cost over $1 million. So you just put all that money at risk for no particular reason. And unfortunately, because the economy is so tight, everybody's just trying to make some money.
Okay.
And
I
that's what
you're going to bring in. Okay, what I want to do is I'm going to bring in some of the callers on the show for any questions that they may have. Any of the callers that are on, welcome caller from 702 area code.
How you doing? This is Mario Coleman. Just wanted to say hello. Just in listening, you got the master architect on the line here giving pretty valid information, so I think I'm going to just kind of sit back and take notes today.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Caller from 651, you want to chime in on any of the concerns or any questions for our guest today? Caller from 651? Okay. Caller from 706?
I had just one question I would like to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Is an architect, are you insured or what?
The good ones are. Like anybody else.
No, but
seriously. Excuse me?
Because of the responsibility, you're saying an architect has that responsibility if something happens to the building.
That's correct.
To know, were you insured? Is a good architect, are they insured, you know, with
yes,
the liability
they,
insurance?
They are. Yeah, because
themselves.
If you think of, exactly, to protect themselves. The ones who are not licensed, they don't need to be because nobody can go after them.
They can get them for fraud.
Well, most people don't even know that's what just happened. I mean, if you went to the planning and building department and watched and saw and dig a little digging, at least 20 to 30% of a lot of these small strip shops, small churches, they may have a stamp on it, but it might be stamped by an engineer,
oh, wow,
which is illegal. The other thing that is illegal is illegal for me as a registered architect to know that I didn't supervise and therefore don't really know anything about this, much about this design of this building, to stamp it.
Okay.
So if somebody approaches, it's sort of like going to a doctor and telling the doctor, I'll pay you $200 to write me a prescription for oxycodone. See, everybody laughs. Everybody laughs because it's so obviously illegal. But that's a similar request, but it happens every single day.
Well, is there a list of where you can find a registered architect?
Here's how you find a registered architect. If he comes to you and says, I'm a registered architect or I'm a registered engineer, go to your state or your professional licensing board. Most of them are online. And you can do an online search by the name of that individual. If you don't see a license beside the number, beside their name, and it's active, they're not. The other thing you can do, just like cosmetologists, when you walk into their shops, they have to have their professional license on the wall.
Okay.
Every professional who's licensed by the state has a small wallet card that shows their professional license. If they can't show you that wallet card, they're not licensed.
Okay.
Well, I'm sorry, but in this article, it said this gentleman had his license that he downloaded from the website, from the internet, and
his
had
degree
it on the
or
wall.
Was it his degree? No, degrees
says,
you can download.
It says that but the college and his clients would find out that the license was fake. And the diploma likely off lifted off of the internet from this gentleman who had no engineering degree,
mm-hmm.
and that he the licenses were fake and the diploma were fake as well. So he had this hanging on his wall. And what would I mean? I guess you can
in a case like that. That's why you go online to the internet, because here's what happened. The state, each state keeps up with all its licensed professionals, and you have to renew your license every few years. Maybe it's like annually, maybe it's every 2 years. But either way, the state makes sure, just a doctor, whatever, you can make sure that this person is licensed for that. You can go online and check. That's why it's best. I don't care which what diploma is from which fancy school is on the wall. Go online with their professional licensing board, and you can put those people's names in. If there's no license shows up for them, they don't have one with that state and cannot practice in that state. They may have one from Timbuktu, but they don't have one for that state. The other thing you have to be careful about is if the person may have been a registered architect in a foreign country, but they still have to have in the United States. Imagine if you were a doctor and you found out, yes, this person was a doctor, but they were a doctor in China or a doctor in Russia or a doctor in Haiti and had never met the standards of care for becoming a doctor in the U.S. You would never go to them. But you would take your million, 3 million, 5 million, $20 million building project and say, here, just because you have your name on the storefront and you have a fancy office.
Ms. Levy,
I have a question for you.
Okay. I know you spoke about some person out there that was doing something very inhumane by using someone's architectural license or signature, and this person had become deceased.
Mm-hmm.
What would the law be against that? Did they get some type of charge, or what would be the consequence of that?
The only reason they were caught and reported was because the building official knew the architect who had died and knew that the architect was dead. So if it was a building official who did not know the architect was dead, it's stamped by a registered architect. Hey.
And he would still be out here just doing it then.
He'd be out there just doing it. Making plenty of money.
I got a question.
Mm-hmm.
It was an article that was on HBO about the Dallas Cowboy, camp. Is this
right.
The same article that killed one player and injured many of in players? This is the same one, because it was interviewing the guy who did the architect. Hello?
Yeah. I'm not familiar with the article. I don't have the article in front of me, so I'm going to put that back to Ms. Karima.
So you're asking was that there was an incident that happened in Dallas that
yeah.
There was a failure in the actual building, and they automatically went and got the architect to find out whether or not the architect had some fault in it, or was he
the building fell down, was a wind hit and the building fell down and injured no one died but injured a couple of players. One player is paralyzed, and the other player is having to be on medication for the rest of his life.
So,
and there was the architect, and the guy said that he wasn't the architect. He was
Ooh.
Just the design person. He did the design, and it was approved by an architect firm. They could not locate the architect firm.
Oh,
That sounds like one of those.
that's a rubber stamper, right? That's somebody mm-hmm. taking somebody else's mm-hmm. designs and rubber stamping it. It's just like, for instance, it's like, and I don't want to say nothing against chiropractors. It's like a chiropractor administering drugs and then getting
mm-hmm.
the doctor to sign off when the patient hasn't been seen by the MD, something like that, or the
exactly.
therapist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But according to this article, the charge to answer the question of the other caller, I believe that was for, it states that the Nowalski case, none of the three engineering firms where he worked for was identified in his November indictment, which charges Nowalski with one count of practice without license and two counts of counterfeiting a public seal. Even though, even after he was charged, he continued seeking engineering work, according to the Howard County State Attorney's Office, which increased his bond as a result, and the trial is set for April 19th. So he has been convicted on numerous theft charges, as according to this article, and the only thing that they got him on that makes sense, of course, this was in Maryland, and in Tennessee, he faced federal tax lien judgment. So that's the only, you know, they charged him with this counterfeiting of a public seal. So I don't know what the to answer the other caller's question. I think that's the best that they could actually do. And as well as the professional licensing board fined him $20,000 for his involvement in it. But apparently this guy is continuing to seek work.
So what happened to the firm, though?
I'm sorry?
Why didn't they charge the firm for hiring him to do that?
Oh, wow. Can they charge the firm? That's a question. You're owner, the principal of your company. Are you responsible, Ms. Nadine?
We would be responsible for the work done on our care, yes.
So would they have charged the actual firm? Would they have charged your firm if you hired somebody and allowed that person to work? Would they charge you?
If they're signing and sealing documents, the firm could easily become liable if the work was done under our firm's name and that kind of stuff. You know, that's one of the things that as firm owners we look into, because a lot of times people moonlight, you know, and moonlight and do things on the side, mm-hmm. and use your title block with your company name on it, and as a result you could easily get drawn into something that has nothing to do with you, because, you know, you didn't even know anything about the project, because they were doing that after hours. Or even if they don't even use your title block, people associate them with your firm because they know
okay.
they work for you, right? So that becomes a place that, you know, we have insurances that cover us from those kind of actions by our employees, but, yes, it opens the door for us to become liable.
Okay. And the only question is it a personal liability on you as being maybe levy, or is it upbill that they would charge you for? Would it be an upbill or
both?
Would it be you?
Both.
Cause it, so they put you in an orange jumpsuit and put you in the Carroll County, huh?
Both. Both, because I cannot, because both, because from a business practice standpoint,
not,
the company
yeah.
is responsible. From a professional practice standpoint, I would be the registered architect. I'm the one who has the expertise. I'm the one who has the training. I'm the one who's responsible for the what we call in the industry the meeting the standard of care. If I was negligent and did not meet the standard of care, which is what would an equally trained and experienced architect in a similar position have done? If I don't meet that standard of care, I open myself up to be liable.
Wow. You know, what's so interesting is that I want to welcome the folks that are on the line. We do have. Out of the folks that are here, we have one, two, three board members who are all involved in the profession of the construction industry. And I know they have a series of questions, but let me just open this up for just a moment. Mr. Coleman, he has a background as an inspector in the Katrina devastation in New Orleans and all. You were licensed and you had a level that you had to produce a standard of care when you went out on the site yourself, right, Mr. Coleman?
Yes, I did. And
so
are you just asking me what was my opinion of what I saw out there as far as shoddy contractors versus professional contractors? And Is that the question, or just what I witnessed while I was out there working?
Well, it's just the relationship in terms of the standard of care when you know, I'm not sure the persons that you work for, but I'm sure everybody had different types of people out there inspecting those areas, and some people just really didn't care about what they reported, and you had other people. So the main goal about the subject matter is the standard of care and the responsibility that you have when the public is looking for you all to give your best professionalism inside what you're doing. So it's pretty much
what I understand what you're saying. Okay. Well, basically, I would say as the most important thing, one of the most important things that needs to be understood and it needs to be implemented into any type of inspector is a level of professionalism and knowledge of what you're doing. And I think the second thing as my job description goes, because I was an adjuster and sent out into, you know, usually into a CAT situation. CAT is short for catastrophe. So I witnessed situations that were actually in some cases even beyond human comprehension when I walked up on somebody's house or whatever. So there is a degree of empathy that needs to be present in your services to these individuals, because first of all, they've paid, you know, for years and years and years into their policy and for this situation to happen. This is actually what they're paying for. So as a professional, you really want to be able to go in there, get an accurate assessment of the damage, and then once you have an accurate assessment of the damage, be able to report that damage to the necessary agency, which in my case was Allstate, in a way that they could see exactly what was going on, be it pictures, be it written estimations, as far as measurements, as far as damage, you know what I mean? Everything needs to coincide with the other so the client's settlement can be done properly and they can be happy with the results. Now, that's not always the case, I mean, because sometimes they may have a policy, they didn't read it, and some of the things that they thought were covered in the policy weren't covered in the policy because they decided to go with a cheaper policy instead of one that maybe was a little bit more detailed and maybe was maybe $5 or $6, $10 more a month, but they decided to go with another one. And then a lot of times you don't find out you're not covered for something until that thing gets damaged, and it's a little too late then. But anyway, for the most part, there is a level of professionalism because there have been situations where you had individuals who have gone out on site onto an individual's property and just really just had a lackadaisical, I don't care type of attitude, and really kind of like gave the organization a bad name. And then another individual, like there's been actually cases where I had to actually go out behind an individual and kind of like had to bear the brunt of their of a client's frustration from the last individual. But to my credit, not trying to toot my own horn, but my level of professionalism usually neutralized the situation once they found out that I cared and I was trying to do the best possible job that mm-hmm. I could for them, which I was getting paid to do anyway. So I hope that answers your question. But to make a long story short, it's really about going out there, trying to do the best job that you possibly can. If you're out there on the web, and there's times where you actually have to go in and do research as far as like what materials are needed for a particular situation to be rectified. So going out there, doing the proper research, trying to find the best materials within the cost range, because as an adjuster, you're working between two entities. You're working between the entity of your client, I mean the insurer, and then you're also working for a company. So there's certain guidelines, certain state regulations and all that you have to adhere to. So you have to work between those. But in the end, if you're trying to do the best possible job that you can for your client, and the insurer knows that, and the company that you work for knows that, they'll pretty much work with you, you know, within reason. So it's really, like I said, about professionalism, giving the best degree of service that you can give. And the other thing that I always tell insurer when I'm asked is like, you know, if this was my house and I walked into it and seen it destroyed at this matter, how would I feel? You know what I mean? This is my residence. It's just been completely demolished or maybe not even livable. You know what I mean? My history, my you know, everything that's involved in there, how would I want somebody to handle that? So that's kind of like the mindset I have whenever I walk into an insurer's house has been damaged.
And I think that's the mindset, I guess, that I was trying to get into about this particular show. It's these are the things that affect our lives and our community and our businesses, because if you know, it starts with the level of the standard of care, and I've learned that over the year of understanding really what that means in terms of an architect. And in terms of a person that's an adjuster, and in terms of the young lady that's online, Janora Borns, who's a licensed general contractor, and then the other young lady that's online that has been a licensed general contractor in the past, and then myself, you know, as people, we have a standard care. And I think that it's revolting to understand that the dollar is just so important to even think about the lives that you impact because you're being cheap, or you're not taking I don't think this is cheap. I think this is about people not having value to other people's lives, and that becomes very revolting. I think the charges against people who are charged with the quality of life protection of individuals, I think the crime, you know, that type of crime should fit the time, you know. And so basically they really should go into more of a criminal aspect. And when they start locking people up 5, 10, 20 years, I think they'll stop doing it. But right now I don't understand, Nadine, why AIA is not actually lobbying for strenuous, you know, laws to put people in jail.
Well, here, let's give you a classic case. There's a case now in the books in Georgia where there's engineers, there's architects, and there's interior designers. The difference between the education of an interior designer and an architect is, number one, the interior designers do not have the extensive education in codes and structures and that kind of stuff to do certain kinds of buildings. However, there's a bill in the House of Representatives right now in Georgia that wants to, in essence, allow an interior designer to have the ability to design exactly what an architect can design, which means It would be legal for an interior designer who has no such experience or education to design something that houses large number of people susceptible to a catastrophe, fire, structural failure, whatever, and injure a lot of people, but not have the educational background, primarily because I think the community, the legal community, just doesn't understand the process. Here's what the AIA did, and I can speak to this because I sit on the AIA Atlanta board.
Okay.
What we have is we have a petition out to all interested parties, to architects, et cetera, to lobby the House of Congress here in Georgia, the House representative here in Georgia, to let them know that we oppose this, and they even got a written recommendation from the professional licensing board that covers architects and interior designers that says do not do it, but the legislators have chosen or are choosing to ignore the recommendation of even the professional licensing board. So this is the mindset that needs to be overcome when your own professional licensing board, who's responsible to oversee the licensing and training and education of these professionals, is telling the legislators don't do this, but they ignore that. That's why you end up with like you do. Because maybe they got lobbied. Maybe they got a friend, a wife, whatever. And there's a lot of money in construction. There's a lot of money in building.
Well, Ms. Robbie, I actually have a question. I'm sorry.
Sure.
I have a question for you. You kind of touched on it a little bit, but, you know, it brought up my curiosity with it. What would you prescribe in your industry if if by chance someone was listening to this radio show that, you know, has the power to make the changes that are necessary? Because this is a bad reflection on other architects that are out here actually doing their job and doing it the correct way and making sure that the public safety is ensured. What could you recommend that they do to increase the standard of care that is out here for the buildings or for the general public?
What we're trying to do is we're trying to have educational sessions. We had something at the High late last year about that would educate people about, for example, designing a home. If you go to the AIA website, you can see how do you select an architect. It tells you all that information out there. We also have we sponsor builds. The AIA Atlanta actually sat down with the city of Atlanta when they're talking about their green building requirements now. You know, a lot of public buildings are requiring you to go, are being required to go green, so save on electricity bills, that kind of stuff. So we are involved in legislative activity and working with building departments and building officials. One of the other things coming up now is because of the economy, a lot of these building departments are losing their inspectors and are going the way of independent inspectors. The jury's still out on, you know, is that really a good thing? For example, in at least two of the counties that I deal with right now, to get a construction project done now, you may have one inspector for the whole county. So if somebody needs a plumbing inspection done, they may have to wait 2 weeks until he gets back around to their project. That means they're sitting with these construction sites not finished. Projects drag on. People lose money. Right? When people lose money, people start cutting corners, it leaves the public at risk. All right? So these are the things that just mushroom. And so we're trying to make sure that we get the word out to as many people as possible. Unfortunately, certain communities are less, have less participation in the built environment, in the policy that generates the built environment, that affects architecture, that affects building codes, that affects all of that kind of stuff. You know, certain communities simply are not at the table. Let's put it that way. When there's only about 1,500 registered architects, African-American architects, in the country out of 100,000. Who's the voice?
Who is the voice
for communities of color? Who is the voice for, you know, when you think about in Atlanta, this whole green initiative that is coming through and is affecting public policy, is affecting how they build cities, that affecting how you get projects, is affecting how they build stuff, I mean, the schools and all this kind of stuff in your neighborhood, right? Or if you think about school systems that, you know, have no, do not encourage participation by minority groups. There's nothing in their contracting language, nothing up there. Then who are the voices to influence the policy?
Well, that's a great question. Let me tell you what I feel personally. You have an educated community becomes a powerful community, and I
yes.
think what has to happen is that the outreach from the AIA needs to be a little bit stronger, and the engineering professionals need to be a little bit more stronger and more visible to our communities. And if that happens, you know, I know
but,
people
but,
of color.
But think
hold
about
on
doing,
a second. Hold on. People of okay. color always want to find a fight. And if you tell them there's some place that they can fight at, you get their attention and speak their language in layman's terms and say, look, not only what you just said to us is that not only what's going to happen is like that mushroom effect. What's about to happen is that even with the money that's coming from the stimulus, and this is the same subject,
mm-hmm.
if people are not getting their projects built in a timely manner in order to achieve their performa that they give to the bank, to show the bank that this is going to be built within 90, 100, or 6 months, then these people's projects are going to slow down, and that people are going to be too afraid to even try to venture out and go into business.
Because
what you're saying is that there's nobody watching the hen house, and they're just continue. It's going to even get worse because there's not going to be anybody watching the hen house, basically.
In other words, what's going to happen is it's going to be private companies. Nothing wrong with capitalism. Who are going to be doing the inspections and not county or government inspectors? What's the motivation? Where, you know, all kind of, in my mind, it raises all kind of questions. I know these new cities like Johns Creek and Milton and Dunwoody, they use a lot of private inspectors. DeKalb County and several other counties around here, because the construction levels have been so low, they've cut all the review staff or their inspection staff. So even if we started a boom tomorrow, they don't have any staff to look at the review, the drawings. They don't have staff to go out and inspect on the sites. So who's watching the hen house? I mean, as part of what an architect normally does is they're responsible for site observation, but if the budgets are cut too low, architects can't afford to go out to be out on site. So again, who's watching the hen house?
Okay. I want to thank you for bringing yourself into the show, and we got about 16 minutes left in the show. So I want to try to move into another part of the architectural world that a lot of people don't understand. It's also a challenge in the hen house situation. And we have another article from March 2nd where architectural firm received pay for unbuilt Florida school, where the Board of Education voted to terminate the architect's contract for this elementary school when they had already knew 3 years that it would not be built. But however, they paid the architect about 70% of this money and then turned around and tried to terminate the contract. and then put the architect at risk, and then turn around and then made the architect feel that they were not going to get their money, but also went on to pay a new architectural firm for a design that they selected and paid him double the money. Isn't there a lot of nepotism going on now?
That's your school board. That's your public money at work. Yeah, that's residents' public money at work. School board gets paid by your property taxes.
Okay.
The millage on your real estate, so much percentage of your property taxes goes towards county government, hospitals, schools. The money from your property taxes is what they use to build a new school. Okay? So if they pay people twice for the same school, that's your taxpayers' money at work. Don't think it's just happening in Florida.
So you're saying this is a normal practice where school boards start spending our taxpayers' money and then turn around and already knew that it was not going to be like a project that was going to exist, and then turn around and re-resurrect the project for double what it would be and pay that out? You're saying that's a norm? That's a norm for school boards? Not just
it's
in
not,
Florida, but...
It may not be, that may be an extreme, but on smaller issues, it happens quite often.
Mm.
It happens quite often. If one group comes in, a new superintendent is selected, new set of board members are selected, they have their pet projects, they want their pet projects over this area and another area, they may not fund or stop work on a project that was over there. Or say, for example, it takes about 3 years for this thing to go through the budget, and say, for example, when they started looking at it, that area of town was booming with kids at elementary school age. By the time they get ready to build the school, demographics have shifted, and there are no kids of elementary school age over there anymore. So why would you put a $20-something million elementary school in a neighborhood that don't have that many kids? So all of a sudden they pick it up and they shift the program to another part of town because that's where all the kids move to.
Yeah, and that's
but it takes it. But it takes two to get the building built.
You must be reading this article because basically that's what it said. They said that they took it, purchased a larger amount of some more land on the other side of town, and then contracted out to another firm and gave them $1.2 million. Where the school is going to be built at. I mean, that's our taxpayers' money.
The tax 22 is this. Because of your taxpayers' money, because the project costs are large, they're mandated to be put out to bid, be put out by RFP. So if they had already engaged an architect to design it on site A on one side of town, and they're no longer any kids over there, they got to pay that person for what they've already done, even if they never built the building. And then they have to, because it's a brand new school on another side of town, they have to put it back out for public bid. So, yes, you are paying for it twice.
Okay. Anybody have a question regarding or comment regarding this kind of issue?
What is it?
Caller from 313. Okay. Caller from 706. Your taxpayer dollars. You happy with that? Okay.
No, I'm not happy with that. But what I was thinking was they need to do a survey or something to find out the age group of the kids before they start actually thinking about building a school.
And they do. They're required to. But think about it. Say, for example, in Atlanta. Atlanta has been booming for the last 10 years. There was a time when there were no young kids in an area of town called Chamblee. They also, when the school system were looking at their stuff, their projection for needs for schools, there were no kids in Chamblee. They never had any plans to put schools in Chamblee, new schools in Chamblee. They haven't been kids in Chamblee since 20 years ago,
oh.
Right? When the white flight happened, okay? Now, in Chamblee, there's a lot of Asians, there's a lot of Hispanics, there's a new demographic who have kids. So now it's 5 years later, there's no plans on the books for new schools in Chamblee. But Chamblee now has a whole brand new crop of kindergartners. Where are these kindergartners going to go in the next year and a half, 2 years? Take on a building, on an elementary school that may be, that's, say, 1,400 kids, right? It may take two, it takes 1 year, a year to a year and a half to build a school because they're huge. And then maybe another almost 6-8 months to design the school. And then to go through the procurement process, another 4 months. So it takes 2.5 years to get from we want to put a school there to having a school there.
Wow.
In 2.5 years, a lot of things can change.
They can make more babies.
They can have more babies, or all the people over there can move and go to Alpharetta.
Hmm. Caller from 651, you got a comment or question since you've been in the industry for a while?
No, I just find it interesting. I'm just sitting back just having a good laugh on it. No, I don't.
You like paying high taxes. That's good. That's
good. I'm cool that way, but, hey, business is business. Until somebody sets some rules and some guidelines, it's still going to be the same.
It's still going to be the same. That's it.
Caller from 702, you have a comment?
No, I'm just sitting back. You know, the other thing, too, I was just thinking about is just some of the work when I did reinspect some of the houses, just some of the work that had been done by some people who didn't. I mean, first of all, you know, like a lot of times when these people get their homes repaired or fixed, they don't even have any idea what's going on because they're usually not there. But, I mean, I've just been places where I've gone to up on roofs or whatever and work was supposedly been done. And, I mean, I could just pick up a whole row of shingles with my hand because they weren't properly nailed down. Or, you know, when you do like you work on like a certain slope, there's supposed to be like so many 6x4s, like say there's supposed to be like four,
mm-hmm.
in order to under plywood, in order for the roof to have a certain degree of strength. Well, there's
mm-hmm.
been times where instead of using maybe four, they just spread them out and just use two. You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
And then I'm on the roof wondering how come it's just like a sponge or whatever, and that's been the reason because these people are using shortcuts or whatever and. You know, people are trying to save money on certain things that they may not think is important, but I mean that they really are. So I think that it's you almost need to do research before you even get your house fixed, and then definitely research on the people that are coming to fix it as well, because you can really get taken, and a lot of times you don't find it out until your roof is caved in, or you know what I'm saying, something really. Really, I don't want to say catastrophic, but something has really happened to where you realize that, you know what, I should have just spent maybe an extra $100 or $200 in order to get this done right because now it's going to cost me a couple thousand to get it redone.
What I keep hearing is, and I'm hearing this from everything, is, you know, the caller from 706 says, where's the standard of care? The caller from 651 is amused and like paying high taxes, but you know, it's okay. You know, where's the standard of care? And from a caller from 702, you know, you're saying where's the standard of care in our guest for the day? You know, where the standard of care? I think in our communities, you know, in these type of discussions, we are the voice of our community, and we need to say where's the standard of care. So go ahead. I'm sorry, Nadine. You can go ahead.
No, I'm just going to follow up on Mr. Coleman's example. One of the things I often find maybe a year or two later when I come back with a homeowner and they're having problems because their house, they're getting water in their house. Or maybe they have termites in their house, and they're wondering what's the problem. And I ask a few questions, and when I look, number one, when they had the roof repaired, nobody put flashing back around the chimney. Nobody put flashing back in the valleys. Nobody put flashing between the roof and the wall. So, I mean, one of the things that you learn is that water and buildings don't mix. So as a designer, your goal is to keep the water out. Sometimes it's as simple as making sure the gutters are on and the downspouts are on, because if they're not, the water laps up underneath the shingles, and even though you just had your roof done, in 2 years and 3 years, the OSB that they put down instead of plywood is now soaked with water, expanded, and rotting. Now, that rotten wood is fertile ground for pests and termites. And then you wonder why your building is falling down.
You know,
so if you think about it, a house can last. There are houses out there, have been standing since the 1900s and earlier. And there are homes out there that have been built in the 80s and 90s and the 2000s, and you almost have to take a bulldozer to them.
That is true.
And you wonder why.
Okay. All right. Well, look, I want to thank all our callers for calling in, and I want to thank our board members for calling in, and we want to let everybody know that the show will start to be aired every Wednesday at 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m., and for the month of March, we will be having Mr. Coleman on doing some special ladies appreciation programs throughout the state of Georgia. And so I want to thank all of our callers for calling in and supporting us. And Ms. Levy, could you please let everybody know where you're located at and your website, please?
Well, Upbuild Design is located at www.upbuild, that's UPBUILD, design, DESIGN.com. And we're in Decatur in Metro Atlanta, and you can reach us at 404-371-1454. We do all kinds of designs, specialize in commercial design, and we are fully licensed and insured.
Okay, and a caller from 706, do you have a website that you'd like people to visit?
Yes, www.youpreventbiz.com. It's a health and wellness.
Okay, health and wellness. And caller from 651, you have a website you want people to visit? Okay, I guess the caller's gone. So I want to thank the rest of you all. I want to ask caller from 313. No, the caller, she's done. I want to thank you all for being on the call. Thank you all. And we're going to end this show with Destiny Muhammad. Grace.
And the voice of all good tidings. I am the sound of angels' laughter across the moonlight bay. I am all you'll ever need. I am all you'll ever need. I am the wisdom of all elders. I'm the wonder in a child's eyes. I am a cool and and gentle breeze on a warm summer's day. I am the blessing you seek. Seek my face, I'm all you will ever need. All you ever
grace so sustained.